Thanks for tuning in to the Lean 911 podcast, where you'll have a voice directly from the Gemba. I will rely on my three decades of Lean successes, as well as my failures, to answer your most challenging questions regarding your Lean transformation. I'm your host, Mark DeLuzio, President and CEO of Lean Horizons Consulting, and the principal architect of the Danaher Business System. Looking forward to your questions. Now, let's go to the Gemba. Welcome to episode 45 with Lean 911. I have a very special guest today. Matter of fact, a good friend, a colleague, a pain in the butt once in a while. He always pushes me, and that's what Cliff does. Cliff Ransom, who I always call, Cliff, I've called you over the years, the lean guy on Wall Street, okay? And everybody says, when I would say, hey, do you know Cliff Ransom, you know, the lean guy on Wall Street? And you and I go way back to Jake Brake into the, I guess, the late 80s, maybe early 90s. But you've been following Danaher. You've been involved with Danaher. I've had you on Kaizen teams, which I do want to talk about, while I was running the Danaher Business System. With George Sherman and then Larry Culp. And you have been an integral part of Danaher and also a mentor to a lot of us. I've learned an awful lot from you in terms of how you think, which is a perspective I don't think a lot of people have. And maybe that's scary that we're going to teach people how Cliff Ransom thinks. I don't know, Cliff. What do you think? But Cliff, you're an unbelievable person. You're a very interesting person. And I'm just very happy to call you my friend, and I'm glad to have you on the show. So let me turn it over to you, and there's so much for us to talk about, but I'm going to kind of let you kind of lead the way.
Well, Mark, I think you had me here because I run an independent equity research firm. Mm-hmm. That's just, and it's called Ransom Research Incorporated. Right. Mm-hmm. You're looking at Ransom Research. I'm a one-man band. In my career on Wall Street, on both the buy and the sell side, I've run research departments. I've been director of research. I've run corporate businesses. And I just didn't want to do it anymore. I got tired of having people working for me. I knew what I liked to do. I knew how I added value. And about 21 years ago, two of my very best institutional clients came to me and said, Cliff, it's clear to us at this point in your career, you are no longer capable of working for someone else. So start your own firm. We'll keep you alive until you figure out a business model. And I said, what business model? Because at the time, there were no people like that. There were two guys like that on Wall Street, one who did autos, one who did banks. I'm sorry, not banks, utilities. It was even duller. And in 6 weeks, I had a handful of institutional clients who used me to go look at companies that they were interested in and to ask me what I thought, knowing their investment styles, what they should be interested in. So I became a screen for them. And I had a couple of folks who worked for me to help me with administrative matters and travel schedules. And I've spent the last, 25 years visiting companies, talking to managements, going to the Gemba, going to where the real work is done. And that's all I do. I go and I look. I try to make judgments because ultimately that's what I'm paid for. And then I write a little. I write when I have something to say. I don't worry about quarterly earnings or deviations. You know, I get so irritated when I look at First Call or any of those things that, you know, XYZ company beat CPS by 2 cents, you know, reports $3 instead of $2.98. Like, who the hell cares about 2 cents a share in a quarter? Or that they miss on their $5.2 billion in revenues by $10 million. Mark, you and I have been around companies long enough to know that $10 million is like, as we all know, GAAP accounting is the death of lean thinking.
You bet.
And as Jim Womack tells us, The only number that does not lie is inventory. And so I look at free cash flow. And I just look, I look for the next Danaher. At the end of the day, that's my job. Now, you made a
But Cliff.
passing comment. Let me quickly add something there. You made a
Yeah, sure.
passing comment to this, and that is there just aren't many Danahers. I've been doing this now as a CEO for 20 some years, and I've got, I think, 14 companies that I call super achievers, and probably five of those are spin-offs from Danaher, and about half of the rest are companies that have been transformed by Danaher alumni. So, or trained by Toyota, the way you were, the way I was, the way George was, the way Larry Culp was, the way Tom Joyce was. It just goes on after and after and after and after. What astounds me is so few people understand the lessons that they had for us to learn. They've all been brilliant performers in the stock market, and that usually gets adherence. But I love being number one on Wall Street and lean, but you know what? I'd rather be number three of 20 because I'd be a hell of a lot more impactful. In the meantime, I love doing what I'm doing, and it's different from a lot of other people, and there's still people out there that'll pay me, and so that gives me a lot of satisfaction.
Cliff, but you're not just one of those analysts, or maybe I'm insulting you by calling you that, but you're not just one of those guys that go in and look at companies. There's plenty of people that go into companies, right? And they don't know what they're looking at, okay? But when you go in, because of your training, you've been involved with me on, I've had you on Kaizen teams, and as a matter of fact, if you recall, when you were working at State Street and at Jenny Montgomery, you had me in to do Kaizen in your own business. I mean, Cliff walks the talk, by the way, when we talk about lean, because he had me in to actually do
Ocean Conway.
Hoshin Kanri. I think we did some process mapping, maybe, or value stream mapping in his investment firms in the research area. Okay, one of the things was lead time on getting out a research report, which was incredibly long. The other thing is that office that you're looking at behind him today, you had me in there doing Kaizen in your office, if you recall. Okay. And
Yes, actually, Mark, the way I remember it is you said you wouldn't help me with Hoshin Kanri for ransom research until I cleaned up the office. Because you said your concepts are great, Cliff, but your 5S stinks.
right. You
I'm
got to
still
walk the
working on it
talk.
25 years later, but I'm getting better.
Well, then I walked the talk, and I told you I'll come down to Baltimore, and I will come in, and we'll spend a few days just in there doing everything we're doing. So all I'm trying to say is that you walk the talk, number one. Okay, a lot of people don't do that. Number two is that you've been involved, and I've had you involved, and I got to actually tell this story. I don't know if it was your idea or not. It might have been your idea, but you said, I think you told me, hey, why don't we have the analyst in from Wall Street into Jake Brake? Remember that?
Yep.
You and Jim Lucas. Jim was your
Yep.
partner at the time.
Yep.
Another great guy, by the way. And you guys came in with all these other, I think we had 25 maybe analysts, right? And the whole idea here, now Jake Brake at the time was our star company. It was the most advanced in lean. We kicked the crap out of so many different things, saved the business. The numbers were phenomenal. One of the more profitable businesses that we had at the time. And it was an OEM business, as you know, Jake Brake's UAW shop. Okay. Regardless of all that, it was one of those businesses that we just performed and turned around from a batch and queue to a one-piece flow. So we would have analysts come in there, Pat Allender and I, who was the CFO at the time, who, by the way, is a neighbor of mine over here in Scottsdale. We're having dinner
A
soon.
great human being,
I
one
love
of the
Pat.
real princes, I think. Go ahead.
And probably one of the best dry humors I've ever had in my life. I saw in my life. But but anyway, so Pat and I still see each other. But the whole idea of this was we're going to teach you analysts how to see a factory. Okay. So I laid out a process that said, okay, well, here's how you guys got to go out in the factory. Now, we want you to go out into our factory and come back with some recommendations. We want you to show us the warts that you see. So they all went out and they all came back and we took their feedback and all that. And by the way, we acted on it, as you know. At the end of this thing, Cliff comes up to me and says, you and Jim came up. Jim was working for you at the time. Okay, Mark, show us the real way to do this. This bullshit. This is bull. We know how to do this, but you were already trained. Show us the real way you look at a factory. So we spent more time doing that. Okay. I couldn't fool you guys. I guess I fooled 28 of them, but not you. Okay. And, but that was just what we got here with Cliff. Cliff is always a consummate learner. Matter of fact, on the bottom of his email, it always closes by saying always learning, right? So you're a lifelong learner. So you go into these companies though, and tell us what you see when you walk in, because, you know, Womack said that about me and Art Byrne, that when you guys go into a factory, you see things nobody else sees. Okay. How did you get that ability? I don't know.
One of the reasons that I get the corporate access that I do is if it's a good management team, they welcome my visits because sure. I'm preoccupied with the same things that they're preoccupied with. I ask the questions that they ask themselves on Friday afternoon at 5 o'clock when they have a martini in their hand, not the kinds of questions that Wall Street asks. You could right. listen to any one of 1,000 transcripts of conference calls and earnings releases, and you'll never hear me say, what's your depreciation rate or what's your tax rate? I don't give a damn. You know, that's their job to manage. It's not something that I'm ever going to impact. But I can say to them, let's do a Gemba walk. Take me, show me what your standard management work looks like. Show me what a huddle looks like. Show me what a problem solving exercise looks like. What's the form that you use on an A3? I will learn more doing that. I tell my clients, they'll say, if you teach us about lean, we can pay you a lot of money. And I say, I'm not in the business to teach lean. I'm in the business of selling fish, not fishing lessons, because I've given up trying to give fishing lessons because it's a very frustrating activity on Wall Street. They're so conditioned by the herd that, I mean, I work with some of the smartest people in the world. No question. Certainly most powerful investors in the world. I tell them, if you'll travel with me, you will learn about lean, but I can't come in and sit in a conference room and give a lean presentation. You have to go to where the work is done. And you guys at Danaher taught me that from the very first day. I had known George. Look, I'd known the Rails brothers for 10 years before they founded Danaher. I'd had a couple of companies taken away from me, public companies that they bought out, which was great because they paid great prices for them. George Sherman had been the number two guy at Black & Decker. And he went to Danaher. And he may have heard the word Toyota, but he came out of Skill, which was an Emerson company, and Black & Decker, where they didn't understand flow and velocity. Stanley Works may not still know about flow and velocity. I don't know.
Right.
I question it. So I called him up about 3 weeks into his stay at Danaher, and I said, George, aren't you the guy that taught me don't try to bullshit a bullshitter? What is all this Japanese you're preaching? I lived in Japan. What do all these words mean? And he said, Cliff, can you get to Bloomfield, Connecticut in 3 weeks? I said, sure. It's an easy hop. I flew to White Plains and drove from there. I walk into the factory to meet him. And I don't know, Mark, let's call it a 200,000 square foot factory. You remember the number, but the point
I'm
making.
It was just north of 200. Yeah, that's about right. Yep.
So about half of it was empty. You all had polished the floors. You had a volleyball court and a basketball court.
That's right.
About another 25% of it was standard straight line production tools piled up, getting ready for distribution. And over in the corner were four cellular one piece flow manufacturing cells, Cat, Cummins, Detroit Diesel.
Mac.
Mac. You had taken on 100% of their Jake Brake production, except for Cummins, who actually invented the damn thing 40, 50 years ago, and didn't quite trust you then yet. And he said, George said, I got to go talk to the guys about something that you can't hear, you know, because I'm used to that. He said, just walk into that cell over there. I said, George, I'm standing here in a three-piece suit. That's a UAW cell, 1990, Rust Belt, Connecticut. Massive dissatisfaction across the global auto industry. So there's going to be a little piece of me in the next 8 Jake Brakes you ship out of here today. He said, no, go on. They're going in. So I went in. So let's say I was 45 years old at the time. I was the youngest guy in the cell because through attrition, they hadn't hired anybody new in a long time because the production had gone up and the quality had gone up through lean thinking, through the institution of what was then the Toyota production system and then the Danaher production system and now the Danaher business system.
Right.
And they're all telling me, okay, here we kaizen to this activity and we pokey yoke this fixture and here's my band. And I said, wait a minute. You guys are all brethren of the United Auto Workers, right? And they said, yeah, proud of it. And I said, well, when you're co-unionists in Jamestown, when somebody drives a Toyota into their parking lot, into that plant, they set fire to the Toyota. And they said, oh, those guys are idiots. They don't know what they're doing. And I said, well, why do you know? And he says, when the railsers took us over, we began to experiment with this. Remember, it was you
Was Art Berner, was George Koenigsaker?
Art Berner, George Koenigsaker.
Bob Pentland?
Yep. And when George came in and he saw it, George is genius. Everybody in Wall Street thinks George invented lean. I respectfully differ with them. But what George saw was the same thing I saw at the end of that visit in Bloomington.
Bloomington. Bloomington.
Bloomfield.
Bloomfield. Bloomfield, yes.
This was not just a better way to make Jake Brakes. This was a better way to go through life.
Yes.
I have put it, you know, Saul was on the road to Damascus. The scales fell from his eyes and he became a Christian. Well, the scales fell from my eyes and I saw immediately the importance of it. So I said to these guys, well, why are you different than your brethren in Lordstown? And they said, well, Danaher took 25 of us to Japan for a month or 3 weeks. And I said, okay, that's a little unusual. He said, yeah, I did this later with Nakao-san myself. I paid him a lot of money to go with him for a week, and you've done it numerous times.
Right.
You go build air conditioners at Hitachi Electric, and then you go to the Toyota Museum and you look at other lean companies and you do some simulations. And then they said, we worked on the floor at Toyota building cars. I said, whoa, wait a minute. You guys are members of the UAW? You're building cars for the great Satan? I said, does your shop steward know about this? And they said, our shop steward was on the floor with us.
Yep.
And Danaher did this over and over and over. I don't know how many acquisitions they made. And they made them all exactly in the same way. They built standardized work. They refined it every time they did one.
Yep.
And I watched them do it again and again and again and again. And that's when Larry went to GE, I said, I've watched this guy do this 200 times. What's new? It's a little bigger, 215,000 people, $100 billion, but the process will be the same. And the generosity, particularly of you and George and Barry, and then the next three or four CEOs and the Rails brothers, because they've been extraordinarily generous to me. I am proud to say that I've never asked them for a favor that they haven't delivered on. Now, Mark, I've said to you before, I'm very careful about what I ask them.
Yep.
I don't ask them for much, but mm-hmm. when I really need help, they've always come to my aid. And that's a hallmark of what lean thinkers do. I can't tell you how many competitors I know that have gone to visit their competitors. They don't talk about stuff they're not allowed to for FTC or FCC or anything else rules, but they share with one another. They share with their suppliers. They share with their end users. And I do the same thing. I share it with my clients, and then I share it with my companies. I've had companies come to me and say, you need to come talk to us about how can we get Wall Street to appreciate what we're doing. I used to do that. I did help Danaher set up that first meeting.
Yep.
Danaher doesn't do those meetings anymore.
Oh, really?
They've just given up.
Oh.
ITW, which is not a lean company, it's an 80-20 company, but the process of a thought process that's that determined, they don't. I was the first and only person I've ever let go through their 3-day orientation program for 80-20 when they make an acquisition, as I did 2 or 3 times at Danaher. And I have one client in particular who's really, really understands this stuff, Cole. He's an institutional investor. I don't want to name him. We've probably done 20 Kaizens together over the last 20 years. We'll go volunteer to spend a week in some company in Germany, in Missouri, in Idaho, in Virginia, in Connecticut, and we'll work on a team. We turn off our iPhones and we go, you know, figure out how to get a welding cell to go from 2 shifts to 1 shift, how to take a component cell at one of the Danaher companies from 2 shifts to 1 shift and increase the production by 50%. And I said, how long do we have? They said, an hour. He said, you can't go do the catapult exercise with the other guys because you've done it before. And you can't do the one piece letter stuffing exercise because you'll screw it up for everybody else. And I said, how long do we have? They said, an hour and a half. I looked at Jim and I said, what the hell? We're leaving this afternoon. If we screw up this cell, they'll fix it in the morning. And we did it because you learn the process, the system. You learn what kinds of questions to ask, and you reconfigure how you think about things.
Well, Cliff, you know, you said a couple of things. Obviously, a lot of everything you said was important. I keep telling people, and this is where leadership is failing, in my opinion, in terms of learning what it is you just said. Okay. And I always like to use outside analogies away from business. And sports is always a really, you know, you're an athlete yourself, and you know, you look at sports and you say, well, can I really learn how to play golf by watching Tiger Woods? Can I really learn how to play golf by reading Ben Hogan's 5 Rules, which I think is the greatest book on golf ever? Okay, I've read it 100 times. Not until you pick up the club. Okay, what videos you want to watch, you got to pick up the club and swing it. And Kaizen is the same exact thing. You have to have experience. You have to screw up. I think I did once or twice in my life. I don't know about you. Okay. And we all make mistakes when we do this. And it's the lessons that we learn from those mistakes that make us grow and give us that wisdom and understanding. Right. And so that's exactly what you did. I know that you paid your way on the study missions to Japan with Nikao. And I've been on, I think, 6. I took Larry over on one of them, Larry Culp. The Rails brothers, multi-billionaires, were on the shop floor doing TPM in Toyota with Nikao, George Sherman. All these guys, Larry came over with me on one of my study missions, and he was building air conditioners. And so, well, wait a minute. You're too busy? You're too important? This is below you? Really? Okay. I'm sorry. And what I think you saw, though, was the value of learning. And again, the only way to learn is to freaking do it.
Is to do it.
Yes. Yes. And, you know, not everybody, you know, I know that might be lost on you. You're sitting there saying, well, why? That's obvious, right? It's obvious to me, but it's not obvious to everybody, which is really sad. And that's where I think a lot of people who are running these companies who claim they're doing lean don't even know which way the shop floor is, never mind, you know. And so
Mark, it's almost worse than that. I've worked with six different lean consulting firms, including yours, and I've had to get you guys to go with CEOs and teach them how to walk into an office or manufacturing plant.
Yep.
I don't know how they got to be CEOs if they didn't know that when you walk into a cell, the first thing you have to do is to give your name. Don't assume they know who you are, or don't assume they know who you are and are going to be deferential. Just say, "Hi, my name's Cliff. What's yours? Tell me what you're doing, Mary. Show me what you're doing." And then if you're smart, you'll ask a question. Do you have to do anything that just drives you crazy? Because I tell you, every job has something that drives them crazy. And 99% of the time, it's muda. It's non-value-added work that does not need to be done.
But nobody's listening to them. That's the problem. And a lot of people too, and I'm sure you've seen this, a lot of companies talk about improvements, talk about making progress and in Kaizen improvements, but they don't provide the framework to their people to do so. They don't give them the training, the time, the resources, the ability to make mistakes, not to be second guessed on Friday afternoon in a Kaizen. Because I had one client. Been there for over 20 years, and the place was a mess. And we held a Kaizen, and he happened to walk in. He was on another Kaizen team. He just wanted to check to see what his team was doing. He started questioning them. Oh, that's not right. That's not right. I pulled him outside. He was a managing director of the company. I pulled him outside into the hallway. I said, "Excuse me." I said, "You've been here for how long?" 23 years. Okay. All of a sudden, you have a flash of genius. All of a sudden, what they did with this Kaizen is, first of all, work on this monstrosity of a what you call a process, which it wasn't a process because it wasn't documented. That's my first rule, okay? And all of a sudden, you all have religion. All of a sudden, have religion and insight as to what they should do. Where the hell was this insight the last 23, 24 years? I said, look, they opened up doors for you that you're now able to look through, okay? To second guess them is the worst thing somebody can do on a Friday afternoon for a Kaizen report out, is to sit there and say, shoulda, woulda, coulda, especially when you weren't involved, okay? You wanna get involved, get on the team, and it's 100% full-time commitment. I would kick, I can't say who it was, but there was a president of a company that came from Danaher. He hired me as a consultant, and I was working with the team. And he came into the back and sat down. I said, "Excuse me. His name was Joe. Joe, can I help you?" "Oh, yeah, I'm just kind of observing what's going on." No, we don't allow observers." "Well, I just want to see what's going on." "No." So I kicked him out.
You're on
Okay.
the team or you're off the team. And if you're
Yeah,
on the team, you don't do anything else.
right. Well, what I
Team
said
gets
was,
kidnapped, you can break
"There's,
the team. But
yeah."
that's it. You know, tsunamis, the team is going to have to work on how do we recover from a tsunami.
Right. Well, I said there's a couple of things here. One is it's disrupting, number one, that you're just walked in and sat there. Plus you have position power and all that crap. Two, you're sending a subliminal message to the team that you're smart enough to be able to get what's going on just by watching. Okay. And you're also sending a message that you don't need to put the time in that they're putting in. So no, out. Okay. Either that or I just said I'm going home. Okay, so he left, and I just don't allow observers. Sorry, no observers.
I tell clients if they'll travel with me, we start with the basics. Said walk into any area. It applies first to a factory, but we can talk later about the migration of lean thinking into the transactional world, carpet land, non-manufacturing, where there's even more muda than there was in manufacturing. And I say, first thing you do when you go in, look up at the lights, look up at the ceiling. Do they have dingy old neon lights where nobody can see what the hell they're doing? Are there cobwebs up there? Are there water stains? Is there buckets, you know, to catch the leaks? Second, look down at the floor. Is it clean? And I don't care what the company is. I've been in forges, which are probably the dirtiest thing anybody could ever be in, where you could eat off the floor. And in forging companies where the owner, private company, had his desk in the middle of the floor because he said, I can hear if something goes wrong. If I'm expecting to hear ka-chang, 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 if I hear ka-chang, 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 I know something's wrong. I can walk right over. So just look at the floor. Is it clean? If they even have barrels of desiccant or bolsters, I will argue they don't understand lean thinking, because the reason they need them is they haven't either taken care of the hydraulic system or the cutting fluid system. And if you don't PM the machines properly, they won't hold tolerances. And if they won't hold tolerances, you won't get quality. And if you don't get quality, you'll never get flow. And by the way, you probably won't get safety either, which is still my first metric. And then I say, look around. Look up, look down, look around. If you can't see the flow, if there's piles of stuff between points of production, if it goes off in straight corners and comes back again, chances are it doesn't have flow. The only thing that's better is to go look at the bathrooms, particularly the women's rooms. And that's less true today because thank God we're finally getting sensible about this. If the bathrooms aren't neat, it says something about rule number two of lean, which is respect for the individual.
Yes.
I don't want to see that the headquarters bathrooms are spick and span with gold fixtures like Trump. I want to see everybody's bathrooms looking that good. And if you don't, I get in big fights with CEOs. You know, I own a couple of shares of stock in each of these companies, but I'm irrelevant. I'm a drop in a drop of a drop. But my clients often will own a lot of the stock. They might own 20 or 30% of the company with it, five or six accounts, before they send me there. They often say, Cliff, I own 8% of this company. Go make sure I'm right. And I go, look. And I say, you're measuring all the wrong stuff. You're measuring margin. Don't measure margin, measure safety. Because if you don't have safety, you won't get employee engagement. If you don't have employee engagement, you'll never get quality, you'll never get delivery, you'll never get innovation, and you'll probably never get productivity. But if you do all six of those things, you're going to get the seventh, which is cost and margin.
You
And
mean
if
you
you don't
can't
get
take margin percent to the bank? I thought you could.
last time I looked,
Yeah,
I can't take earnings to the bank.
right.
Okay, forget about margin. And people don't understand lean companies increase margin every year, unless, and I'll come to the lesson in a minute. United Technologies, admittedly, they shifted 30 years ago from being an auto parts company to being aerospace and elevators and big aftermarkets and escalators and HVAC. They increased operating margins 50 basis points a year for 20 years. Danaher started off with a 3, 4, 5% margin. At one point, it was negative at Jake Brake. Danaher buys these companies at 5 and 10% margin, and a year later, they're at 15. And 10 years later, they're at 25. And they spun the original industrial assets out of Danaher into Fortive. Jim Lico, who was a longtime senior leader at Danaher, became a CEO of Fortive. He said, there's not a single business I have. These were the first companies we ever leaned out that I don't have 250 to 300 basis points of margin that I can see that I can capture. Now, I don't want them to show 100 basis points of margin a year. I want them to show 50 and take the other 50 and build the business. Feet on the street, new product development, training,
You know, Cliff,
acquisitions.
that's from the book of George Sherman right there, what you just said, because I remember we had a business out in Cleveland, the Cleveland area anyway. It was the best performing business margin wise, okay, operating income wise. They were making, now I'm not talking about gross margin now, I'm talking about operating EBIT, okay? They were making 40%, okay? EBIT. But they were the worst DBS company in our portfolio, the worst. Now, we went in and changed it. Matter of fact, Max Mitchell worked there. We hired Max, who's now the CEO of Crane. Okay, Max worked for me.
Doing a wonderful job.
He's doing a great job. Max is a great guy. And Max worked for me in the DBS office for about a year and then went out to do other things. But this business was our worst DBS plant. If you walked in, you would have puked. Okay. We turned it around. Don't get me wrong. We solarized it to all the things we needed to do, standard work and all that. But what George said was, I want you to take your margin to 35%. And the president of the company looked at him like he was nuts. But I wanted to take this $40 million business and make it an $80 million business. Take five margin points. You know, 35% of 80, I think, is better than 40% of 40, unless I got my math wrong. Okay. But that was George. Invest in the business and take the margin down. Now, most CEOs would say, I want to see how you're going to get the 45% and not grow that 40 million. Okay. And that's exactly what George's thinking was. George was brilliant, as we all know. God rest his soul. He was a brilliant strategist, and I learned so much. He was also a walking Pareto diagram. He would say to me, Mark, I know that's fun, but that's not what's important right now. We got to work on this instead. You know, he was a walking Pareto diagram, and he told me one time as CEO, he says, I'm working on two things. I already got the plans in place to execute over the next 3 years. I'm working on 3 years out, and I'm working on people. Those are my two things I'm working on. Okay. Probably not in that order, by the way. Okay. Yep. And you know, I worked for him for almost a decade, and what an experience that was. But you've been with him in so many different ways. You know, and the funny thing too, Cliff, is when I would take an analyst around the business, they would come in from all the different firms and I'd do a tour. The questions they would ask, I knew enough, and I'm an ex-finance guy, of course. Well, I was their Jake Brake CFO at one time, working for Koenigsegger. You know, I knew the questions they were asking me were questions they needed answered so they could fill out a cell in their spreadsheet. Okay? I knew it. I know what they're asking at, right? I need that answer so I can plug it in my formula. You never asked those questions. Okay? You never did that.
I spent 35 years building spreadsheets. I'm cleaning out my basement, and I found I used to use ledger paper and pencils. Big, huge pieces of ledger paper.
I was working at that time.
Yeah,
yes.
We all did. We had to. Yeah. I mean, else.
I had a nice $35
back
pencil.
And forth. I mean, you know,
I had a $35
dinosaurs
pencil.
Roamed the earth. The ice covered Europe. You know, all of that stuff. And I tell my clients, I pride myself on not having built a model since 2004, the year after I started my firm. Because models don't add any value. They've right. never told anybody when to buy, hold, or sell a stock.
Yep.
I would much rather know what the street's consensus is and understand whether they're going to beat it or not. Because what the street doesn't understand is that Kaizen means continuous improvement. And the adjective is important, continuous. It never freaking stops. I was at a meeting 6 months ago for GE in New York. Larry Culp was explaining what the transformation of GE was all about. And some guy asked him, well, what inning are you in? And I literally shouted out in the meeting, one of the advantages of getting to be an old fart, you can do this. I said, stop it. Stop asking that question. Lean. I played sports. I'm not a sports fan. Lean is a baseball game with an infinite number of innings.
The whole question.
And you got to get better every
end. Yeah. The whole question suggests there's an end, and it's not an end. Exact. Good for you. Good for you. By the way, just to give you a little feel for, because, you know, again, I've chummed around with Cliff all these years and known Cliff for, God, it's got to be more than 30 years, right? I mean, 34 years?
1990.
Yeah, yeah. So 34 years. 30. If I did my math right, 34 years. Yep. But here's the kind of questions Cliff would ask when he would walk into a factory. He would ask me or ask, let's say, the operations leaders or whoever. How does that guy over there know What are you supposed to do today?
My favorite question is, it's now 3:53 in the afternoon. How do you, Mr. Plant Manager, know whether this cell is ahead or behind for the day?
What's the status?
Period.
Yep. Yep. Yep.
And did you check at 10, noon, and 2? So that if they were behind for the day, you could do something to add resources? Ben Taylor, who is a lean guru at Goodyear Tire, which is a pretty interesting company in itself. Billy had the one-eyed man on a horse rule. He said, the graphics have to be good enough that if I'm a one-eyed man on a horse and I walk past the cell on the horse, I'm walking the horse, I know when to rein, get off the horse, get down and walk over and say, what help can I provide? I got to be able to see it. The graphics, the measurements, the metrics have to be visible. Standard work has to be visible.
Yep.
Don't tell me it's in a binder, because when I go to look for the binder, I'm going to find it in the bottom drawer of a file cabinet that hasn't been opened in 5 years. And that's not anybody's standard
work. Better. Yeah, I like when they say, oh, we got it in our system.
Yeah.
I haven't been able to read that. Well,
Mark, I'm a sailor. I won't get on a boat unless you tell me where the charts are. We've all got GPS and radar and LORAN and sat-nav and everything else. I say, that's great. But if we go offshore, where are the charts? Because I want to get home.
Well, at least you know how to read them. But, well, I'll tell you. So the other questions you would ask, and I was trying to give people a different flavor for what kind of and again, I don't know if I'm insulting you by calling you an analyst, but...
No, I'm definitely an analyst.
Okay, so... here's a different kind of questions. Okay. How does that guy know what he's doing? How does he know what he's supposed to be doing? Did he have a good day today? Is he having a good day today? That number on that Gemba board is red. What did you do about it? What's this inventory doing here? How come this compound has 50 containers in it? What if it only had 25? Okay. What would happen? You know, those are the kind of questions that Cliff would ask, and it'd be thought provoking. They'd make you think. And they're just different questions that you would get from any other analyst. The other analyst would say, what's your overhead rate on direct labor? Who gives a flying, you know, what? What do you depreciate this machines at? You know, how old is your equipment and how, when's your next labor contract coming out and what's your average wage rate? And they'd ask all these things that would fit into a spreadsheet somewhere. And so that they can hit the button and come up with an answer.
My absolute classic is I'll walk in and I'll look at their making power tools and I'll say, what are your whip turns? About 80% of the time, they don't know their whip turns. Okay. Or they'll say, okay, we turn 6 times a year. And I go, 6? This is where I lose it. You know, you're supposed to ask questions and then shut up and listen to the answers. I still lose it. They say, 6? He said, this is an assembly business. The most complicated thing you do is wire a coil, you know, which is automatic. And I said, and they'll say, Cliff, we're so much more efficient than our biggest competitors at 4 turns. I said, they're more disgraceful than you are. They say, we're better than everybody else. You're better than who? You know, some German company that doesn't know if it's a for-profit institution or a charitable foundation. I said, I want you to say, you're not better. It's a power tool. You all have the same turns as a cell phone, you know, and they don't get it. They just don't get it.
Polish guy. The worst thing you do is benchmark against your own industry. I mean,
never benchmark your competitors. No. Benchmark the best.
That's right. That's right. Well, because you end up becoming the tallest guy in the Pygmy Village and you're only 3 feet tall. Okay. Yep. Until Shaq O'Neal comes in. I always tell CEOs, hey, the worst thing that can happen to you is on Monday morning, you open up the Wall Street Journal and you find out Toyota's coming into your industry. Okay. Besides losing this
engines and Hondas coming into your industry.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and you know, you just don't, you know, well, you know, I think,
your view on the world, and I also think, quite frankly, to be honest with you, other people have been exposed to some of this stuff out of your world, but they just didn't get it. Okay, they just didn't get it, and it's interesting how. Well, I don't know. I look at it and say, well, that's all common sense. It's not common sense because you have to think differently, like you alluded to. I mean, when Nicole came in the first time and said to us, you need to slow that machine down and you need to do more changeovers, we thought it was nuts. We thought it was nuts. What are you, nuts? You know? And I'm sure some of the things that you heard the first time.
It's almost worse than that because you can then explain them the implications of slowing down the machine, having higher quality, having happier employees. And when you have higher quality, if you're complete and on-time delivery 100% of the time, you're going to get 80% of your customers' orders.
That's right.
And if you're lucky, you're going to get 100% of them.
That's right.
And you're going to work out a cost-sharing arrangement so that when you get better, you get a little piece of it. I once was asked to testify before the Defense Sciences Review Board. This was back in the 90s, and they were trying to do something about Department of Defense procurement strategies. I said, you guys have got it all wrong. These companies figure out a way to make the thing better, and then you take it all away from them. No, if Lockheed makes an F-35 more efficiently, that's probably not a good example because it really took a long time to get that up off the ground.
Well, that was a bad example.
Well, no, but it's an incredible weapon.
Oh,
it's
I know.
Just 10 years longer than it should.
By the way, they're housed right over here, not too far from me at Luke Air Force Base.
Yep, absolutely.
In Arizona, yeah.
But when you do that, you have what Danaher and Toyota have been doing for years, working collaboratively with their suppliers.
Right.
Toyota's biggest problem, it came to the States because they'd always made cars in Japan, but it was afraid it would get hit with tariffs. So they said, we got to build an American plant. They had to learn how to use American labor and American suppliers. General Motors didn't know how to make a small car profitably. So that was General Motors' job. So they started NUMMI. The first thing Toyota did as the managing partner, I think it was 50-50, but they were the managing partner. They said, we're going to rehire all of the union labor that we had.
Yep.
That
yep.
You guys closed the plant because it had the worst union relations. I can only think of two places in the country since the Second World War that had been worse. And they said, we're going to give first priority to the ex-union members. And GM hit the roof. And they said, and oh, by the way, the first person we hired was the old shop steward who had led that union revolt. And within 1 year, it was the most profitable plant in GM history.
It went from last to first.
There's a great NPR case study. We talked about not doing podcasts, but there's a transcript. Anybody who really wants to understand what transformation means, Shook was there. A lot of people were there. It was an amazing story. Toyota learned an immense amount. I will argue, at the risk of irritating all of your GM listeners, GM learned nothing from that exercise.
No.
They still don't get it 30 years later, 40 years later.
I still got battles with some of the engineers there that are doing theory of constraints. They think that's the way to go. Well, you know, Fremont,
it is a
California,
way to go. It is a good way to go, but it's not the best way to go.
Right. That's right.
You know, Fremont, like California. Six Sigma is one of 50 tools inside of me.
And it is a tool, right? That's all it is. By the way, Fremont, California, I thought it was very ironic where, Marianne Keller wrote a book called Relevance Lost years ago about GM's billions of dollars of investment into robotics and automation. So we do Fremont, California, a joint venture called NUMMI, New United Motors Manufacturing, Inc., and joint venture between GM and Toyota. And that's where Toyota kind of learned how to deal here with our supply base and people. And you're right. They took it from the last in the world for GM to the first tops in GM in a very short order. And by the way, Design Dimensions International, DDI out of Pittsburgh, was what they used to hire people there. And I got trained in that. Conus Acres sent me and others to train on this process as to how we hire. And Cliff, you have to go through, I'm talking about shop floor people, supervisors. I'm not talking about executives, okay? We had to go through 25 people to get one, okay? Interview 25 people. And by the way, interview is the worst way to hire somebody. We put them through simulations and all kinds of other things. But it was worth it. The people we got out of that was phenomenal. And so DDI, it's called. So I got trained in that. But the thing about
what was DDI? Whole, what was the name?
Design Dimension International out of Pittsburgh. Yeah, it's a, like an HR type firm. And that's what Toyota used here, okay, when they came here. So the interesting thing about Fremont is after the whole NUMMI thing, and you're right, they didn't, GM didn't learn anything from that. Who goes in that same plant was Elon Musk with his robotics, okay? And it was a complete disaster, okay? He learned nothing from it either, all right? But the government was subsidizing him to the tune of $5 billion, so he didn't feel the pain as much. But he went in there, and then he finally moved out. And that, I don't know what's in there now. I don't know if that plant is vacant or not. But the point is, though, it broke the paradigm that, oh, that only works in Japan. Okay. It's Japanese. It's cultural. No, it's not. No, it's not. How can they do it in Ireland?
It's worse than that, Mark. People assume that all Japanese companies are lean.
No.
Japanese companies are in so much worse shape than the disaster in the United States and Europe. There's a handful of companies in Japan, like there's a handful of companies in the US, a handful in Mexico, a handful in Europe, and the rest of them are patriarchal, hierarchical, they're still, you know, salarymen working until 10 o'clock at night and then drinking until 1 and getting on the train for 2 hours to go home and get, you know, I mean, it's awful. And I've been in some plants in Japan that were as bad as anything I saw in the U.S.
There's some train wrecks over there. Yeah, that's right. That's right.
So hey, it's not Japanese. It's Toyota.
That's right. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Cliff, I have to ask you a question. Did you ever go to Danaher South Carolina acquisition that we had? I can't remember the name of it, but we made
Clemson.
No, not Clemson. It was just across the border from North Carolina, and it was a it was in Lancaster, South Carolina, I think. Anyway, they made the fire pumps that would pump water from one floor to another in a building. I don't know if you ever went to
that. I did not know that. I have made a visit.
Okay. Well, you might want to tell Larry Kulpitz. I haven't talked to Larry in a long time, but at that plant, they made the rheostat for the GE locomotives. Okay, the old rheostats, like you were a kid, you had that thing that would control your train set. Okay.
Yep.
So we would hand wind them. When you said winding before, and I thought I'd bring this up because you'd be interested in this, hand wind these motors that went into. They made them the same way as they did back in the 1920s. Okay, no different. Lady sitting at a desk, right? So I was working on that process, trying to cellularize it and all that good stuff. And I asked the supervisor, hey, do you guys have a print of this particular part? He opens up the Vidmar cabinet, Stanley Vidmar cabinet, you know, those big drawers. He pulls out this big print. And I'm looking at it. It's the original print. And guess who designed it? Signed, Thomas Edison. Now, Cliff, this had coffee stains on it, okay? Coffee cups, you know. I'm like, well, guys, this is the original print. Yeah? This should be in a freaking Smithsonian. So I took it to the engineering lab, and I had them do a plot. They plotted it out, and I brought the copy out, and I had them frame the original. Can you imagine that? Thomas Edison. He invented the rheostat, the GE locomotive, and they had the thing sitting in the drawer like it was just some other yesterday's news.
You know, and that was Edison who experimented with, I think, 1,000 filaments before he found one that wouldn't burn out too quickly in his first light bulbs. If anybody understood experimentation and change and adaptation and morphing a product in a process, Edison did. Amazing.
Well, he said, I didn't fail 10,000 times. I just found 10,000 ways it wouldn't work. So he looked at him as a success, you know.
You know, I wrote a piece years ago called Language Counts. And one of the things that people have to do, and this is so hard for us, maybe as Americans. In my little firm, The most I ever had supporting me were 2.6 people, administrative people. 2.6, billing, pay bills, collect, you know, help with travel. I said, we are not allowed to use the word blame. Not allowed to say, that's my fault. I'm never going to care if you make a mistake. If you can answer the question, what did we learn from this? What are we going to do differently? Now that we know that doesn't work, what can we think of? What two or three ways can we think of to do it a different way? And getting people to stop using the word fault and blame. Fault means something in electricity, but other than that, no.
I understand. Yeah, no, got it.
And it's really hard. And I gave a lecture one time. I gave a presentation. I did a thing for Jim Womack's Lean Enterprise Institute. And Helen Zack, who was the president of Lean Enterprise at the time, said, Cliff, if you can get there a day early, John Shook's doing a two-day workshop on his book, Managing to Learn, which is must reading for everybody who ever looked at this stuff. And I had read it. And so before I went there, I read it again. And then the first day of the two-day seminar, workshop, we read it as a group, basically. And the second day I said, you know, John, I'm really working hard on this asking questions thing instead of barking orders. I'd always succeeded in sports, in the military, which I worked for some strange people in the military, because if they said, take the hill, I'd go take the hill. I wouldn't tell them I might use North Korean mercenaries, which is not something they would have liked, but I'd take the hill. And I really worked asking questions then. And he didn't quite say, wax on, wax off, little grasshopper. He didn't quite say, as George Sherman once did, have I taught you nothing? And George did say one time, he said, yes, Cliff, I can see you're working hard at asking questions, but you're still asking questions that drive people to your preconceived conclusions. That was 15 years ago. And I think about that every day, because I'm still beating that tendency out of myself. You can't do that. In 2009, I was the chairman of the Shingo Institute, a leading generator for the lean world. And somebody canceled to be a keynote speaker. And Bob Miller, who was the executive director, said, Cliff, can you fill in and talk about, you know, how you see lean? I said, yeah, I can always talk. Sure, no problem. So I gave a speech, and at the end of it, I said, has anybody seen anything different in this speech? There were 250. Oh, and I said, I'm going to give a speech on why lean has failed in America in its first 20 years. And he said, if you want to irritate 300 people in the middle of the worst recession, said, Bob, the recession's over in May of 2009. Just stop using that excuse. We've got to get beyond it. I said, does anybody see a difference in the speech? Nobody did. Every single slide, 20 slides, 45 minutes, was a question. And I didn't answer a single one. I just posed the questions. And here were the self-identified, most cognizant lean thinkers on the planet, and they missed it. I got to tell you, if I gave that speech again to Shingo again, or to AME, or SME, or to half a dozen of the consulting firms, I bet you we have almost as many people not understand. You got to ask questions, and you got to ask the right questions. I've been trying to do this for 30 years, and I'm still learning how to do it. It's a struggle.
Socratic
George
method.
Was a master at it. Larry Culp is a freaking genius at it. A couple of the consultants are terrific at it. The best guys, you know, Max and Lico and, you know, pick any of the last three CEOs at Parker Hannifin. George Dave was the most imperial of CEOs at United Technologies, was also a deeply lean thinker. He understood how to walk into a plant. Yeah, he was hobnobbing with Al Haig, who was on his board, and he was talking to the chairman of China. But George would walk into every time he went to visit a plant, he'd have a meeting with 20 or 30 workers. And I'd say, George, you're just setting, you know, this is a setup deal. You know the questions. He said, Cliff, I promise you, I don't know what they're going to ask. And he would talk. You know, there might be 3,000 people in the plant. He had 30 of them in the room. But George got it. And George drove it. George was the guy who had to beat on Shingajitsu for years before they would deign to come consult at United Technologies. It's like the story of the fellow that ran Porsche, tried for years to get Shingajitsu to come in, and they finally did. And the, you know, German companies tended to be very hierarchical. Your rank was determined by the color of your lab coat. He walked in and he shouted at the top of his lungs, "No, no, no, I wanted to go see the manufacturing facility, not the warehouse." And the first thing is he did is he told the CEO of Porsche, who was a family member of the controlling shareholders, to take a circular saw and cut down the inventory racks from 20 feet high to whatever it is, six, you know, five. Because you can't, if you have 40-foot racks, you're going to fill them. I just did a, I'm an appraiser for both AME and used to be for Shingo. And so when they apply for the Shingo Prize and an AME annual award, we go in for 3 days, a group of five or six people, and we tear the company apart. We tear the facility apart. We don't do whole companies. And we went into a production facility in China that makes consumer products. And we found a warehouse that was probably 100,000 square feet with racks that were 80 feet tall. And I hit the roof. I just lost it. I said, this is a product that should be, you should be making, you know, you should have whip turns of 50 would be a good place to start, not eight. And in the space of the next 2 weeks, we found two more warehouses of equal size that they didn't want to tell us about. Well, God bless them. They understood that, and they're working very hard to apply for the prize again and not show those kinds of thought processes that held them back. And they'll do it because they're very disciplined.
Well, you know, Cliff, there's so much to talk about. Let me ask you a question about Wall Street. Actually, what do you see as you go around the country and around the world, actually, and what's different today in leadership? Let's just say at the C-suite, at the CEO level, is there anything different, good or bad, today than there was, let's say, well, I don't know, 20 years ago, 25
well,
years ago?
20 years ago, I made up a number on a whole cloth. I just pulled it right out of my ear. And I said, if I'm lucky, I can find 3 to 4% of companies that I can call super achievers. Nobody's expert. I say to my clients, if somebody tells you he's an expert on lean, be polite, but disengage from the conversation because that
absolutely
doesn't understand what continuous improvement means.
I reject that moniker. Anytime somebody says, hey, Mark's an expert. Nope, I'm a student.
And I go to AME conventions. I'm a Hall of Fame member. I'm a champion. I'm an examiner. And they give red badges, big red badges to the newbies the first time so that if they look lost, somebody with a blue badge goes up and says, may I help you? It's a great idea. It's a member-run organization. It's unusual. I always demand a red badge. It infuriates because I say, I'm just learning, guys. I'm always learning. I'm just learning. I'm here to figure out what I used to do yesterday that was stupid. Toyota says we learn more from our mistakes than from our successes. And on that basis, I'm the smartest guy in the world, given the number of mistakes I've made.
See, I only made one or two in my life, Cliff. So I can't relate to you lower people, if you will.
My line is, I thought I made a mistake once, but I made a mistake.
Yeah, that was your mistake. But
The fact of the matter is that unless you have that openness of spirit, you can't do this stuff. And I thought 95% of companies, the point I was making about the 5%, I just made it up and I told everybody it's a wild guess. And today I say maybe 5% of companies are really lean, are working at it, are getting there.
Or getting
I've
it, yeah.
got 16 companies that are super achievers. I probably have 50 that I call next generation Danahers. That's not a very elegant phrase, but I hope it gets the point across. But people have been on the next generation Danaher list for 10 years
Yeah.
before I move them to super achiever.
Yeah.
It's very frustrating for some of these CEOs. And I say, stop worrying. Not one of your customers cares if you're a super achiever in the parlance of ransom research. Not one of your employees cares. Not one. I care because then I can say, let's talk about what these guys are doing right. And let's go visit them so you can learn what they're doing right.
Well, that's one of the reasons why when I was running DBS, because
And the
George.
number of backsliders is awful.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Awful.
Oh my God. Yeah. Well, you know,
Terrifying.
my book that you wrote a testimonial for called Flatlined, why Lean Transformations Fail and What to Do About It. That book, the reason I called it Flatlined, this is when a CEO calls me. He or she would say, "Hey, Mark, we're in our 10th year of lean, and we just have flatlined." And I kept hearing that word over and over again, because as you know, they teach us up at Harvard. They teach DB up at Harvard. They go up there for their OPM certificates or their MBAs. They learn about DBS. Then they call me, and so many think there's a magic elixir that I could sell them that would be able to just sprinkle a little holy water here and there. And we're in this Amazon world today where everybody wants quick results. We're shortening up baseball games. Nobody has time for this. I can order something right now, Cliff, and maybe by the time I'm done with this call, it might be sitting on my doorstep from Amazon. So everybody is so stressed with time. Nobody has patience, and nobody wants to do the hard work that you've been talking about in terms of the basics. You're a sports guy, and I still use Vince Lombardi, as the his first practice with this broken Packers team in the 60s, he held up a football and said, "Gentlemen, this is a football." And from there, he worked on the basics of blocking, tackling, passing, and how many championships did the guy win? Okay, some arguably the greatest coach in football history. And why? He worked on the basics. He probably would puke at the shotgun. He'd probably puke at the West Coast offense. Okay. And it's like basics, guys. Basics.
I'm like
Okay.
the last guy alive, Mark, who played single wing football in college. And because I was a pulling guard, my role model, my idol was Fuzzy Thurston, number 63. I've got my jersey downstairs. The fact of the matter is that
By the way,
if
let me stop you
ground,
there. You were
what?
friends with Johnny Unitas, weren't you?
Well, yeah, I mean, I knew him. His son was a good friend of my son's, and I coached his kid.
Okay. I'm sorry, I just
Johnny
interrupted you
was a real sweetheart.
there.
The guy, the football stars in those days made $30,000 a year.
Oh, they love of the game. Yeah.
Yeah, love of the game.
I
And he
met
was
Ray
a
Nitschke
wonderful
once, right?
human being.
You know, I met Ray Nitschke at one of our tool shows that you've been to many times out in the McCormick Place.
Yeah.
I have his football card. And he said, and he was so nice to me. He spent a half an hour with me. He wrote a nice thing for my son, who's now passed away. He was a Green Bay fan, and a nice big black and white picture, a nice personalized autograph message. And I still have it. But he said, "Come back next year," and he said, "I will sign your football card." I said, "Okay." Well, that winter he died.
Ooh.
Yeah, he died driving. I think he was driving his car, and he had a heart attack or something, and he passed away. But he was at the tool show, standing there by himself, Cliff, nobody talking to him.
Yeah.
Walked up to him and spent half an hour with him.
Yeah,
Anyway, I'm sorry. I diverted here.
no,
So.
no, that's all right. But those guys understood that it's about blocking and tackling and learning when you pull, you got to throw your arm across your body. You look at these gymnasts, the discipline,
right?
The way they do it over and over, do it 10,000 times. Matsushita Miyamoto, the greatest samurai warrior who ever lived, said, I'm always sharpening my sword. 10,000 strokes to the left, you get pretty good at going to the left. 10,000 strokes to the right, you get pretty good going to the right. And you got to do it over and over again. And then you got to say, well, what if I overlap my thumb? Well, that's a bad idea. What happened if I overlap my little finger? Is that a better way to do it? Just keep experimenting and find better ways to do it. And if you fail, say, well, okay, as you say, with I had 10,000 ways it didn't work. I can't find a lot of people like that.
Okay.
And I talk about my CRISP model, you know, like CRISP, CRISSP. I've written reports on, can you get CRISP? And that means when you get to be, when Wall Street understands that you can produce consistently good results, they say, well, there's less risk, so I can give them a higher multiple. Multiple is, after all, the inverse of the discount rate. And if you can prove that it's repeatable, consistent and repeatable, that you can do it with some consistency, that it's improvable, that you can make it better every year, that it's integratable so that you can start new businesses or buy businesses and bring them into the system. You can prove that it's scalable, that first S. You get your way to the threshold of the two most important words, which is sustainable, meaning you know why it is consistent, repeatable, improvable, integratable, and scalable. And then finally, Wall Street says, well, you're predictable. And when you're predictable, you get a 20 plus multiple. Now, the way we make money in the stock market is not because earnings go up. That's a de rigueur statement. But, you know, earnings might go up 10, 15% a year. That's a tremendous increase, by the way. It goes up. The stock price goes up because the valuation, the price earnings ratio, the multiple goes up.
Right.
And Danaher went from 8 times earnings to 30 times earnings. And in the process, grew earnings by, I don't know, 10 times probably over a 30-year period, and stock went from 1 to 300. That's, if you talk to Mitch Rales or Steve Rales, there's a very good interview with Mitch. He told some stories that I'd never heard him tell in public before. He doesn't invest unless he thinks he can make 100 times his money.
Yeah.
I'm not smart enough to say that. I say that when I invest, I never want to have to sell the stock.
Mm.
I want to own it forever.
Mm.
And that's why my clients have never cared if I bought for myself, fully disclosed, anything I asked them to buy. And it's because we shared in that good fortune, good luck, smart thinking, whatever you want to call it, mostly luck. We've all made a lot of money.
Well, Cliff, I tell you what, we're going to close it right now. We're about that magic hour. And it's been a pleasure having you on. We're going to have you back. So there's so many other things we need to talk about.
Well, Mark, you and I have been hanging out together now for, let's do this, 34 years.
Right.
And we've both learned an immense amount. And we both know when we started, we didn't know squat.
I still feel that way.
Well, I'm getting dangerous. My life is, people say, why don't you retire? I say, I'm having too much fun. It took me 52 years to get to be dangerous. I'm just getting dangerous. I'm having too much fun.
I don't know, Cliff. I thought I always thought you were dangerous every time you walked in my factory. So,
well, I'm delighted.
My friend, this has been a pleasure. I think there's so much more we need to talk about, and we will probably whoop back with you another time and get this moving. And I wish you the best. You look great. Your office looks pretty. I'm going to give your office a B plus, maybe B minus on 5S.
Well, Mark, in the interest of continuous improvement, if you'd been in here the last time say 15 years ago, what grade would you have given me then?
Oh, when I came in that day?
D minus?
I was in your office.
That's my point.
You wouldn't have even been allowed into the school.
Thank you. Thank you for recognizing I'm moving in the right direction.
But it was a pleasure working with you then, because it was like you were so. I'll just tell a little story here, okay? I mean, you seem to remember you had three printers. You had a high speed color printer, you had a black and white printer, and you had a regular, you know, color just printer.
Just two.
Oh no, you had grasshopper. Please do not argue with sensei.
Thank you.
But anyway, I believe you 5S some of those, and but we cleaned a lot of things. And then the whole other thing was, you know, we were in a transition then too of moving from more of a paper world to an electronic world too. That's the other thing you got to realize, that boy, paper was something else, man. I'm so glad we're sort of rid of that. But then it, of course, it provides other challenges, right? Being non.
Well, Mark, I used to keep paper documents. I would keep, it was a terribly difficult day when I threw out 40 years of McCormick and Company annual reports, because every annual report was flavored with a different spice. But 40 of them is like this much in a file drawer.
Yeah.
Today, I used to give the folks that work for me, I don't know, 6 or 8 inches of filing a week. I don't give them 3 pieces of paper a month.
Yeah, I hate paper.
Because
it's
all available electronically. And I never.
You know, I also have this rocket book. This is a little one, but I got a bigger one where I can write on this, snap it. It goes into a file, into a PDF. I can file it anywhere I want, and it's not a problem.
What is that?
It's called a rocket book. It's called a rocket book. And so I got one, a large one and a small one. And here's my large one. Okay.
Tell me how to spell it and I'll look it up.
Just like Rocket, ROCKETBOOK. Get them on Amazon. And the neat part about them, Cliff, you erase them afterwards with just a tissue and a little bit of water. You buy special pens for them. Okay. And you erase it and you just reuse it. That's what I do. Yeah. And it's
I carry around a series of grid notebooks.
Yep.
I did this to suck up to the guys at Shingajitsu, because then I could draw diagrams neatly. So sketching a plant or even sketching a machine, they would see me doing it on grid paper, not on line paper. And they would say, oh, well done. Well done.
I'm sure they would appreciate that. Absolutely.
Well, it
Cliff,
helps
my friend, this was a lot of fun. Good insights. I hope the listeners today can see the lean world through a different set of lenses, because Cliff looks at the world differently. He taught me a lot in terms of how to look at things, and even through, you know, what goes through his mind as an investor and as an analyst looking at companies. And by the way, if you can understand how Cliff sees the world, it's going to do you a lot of good. And hey, it might even improve your multiple on your stock price. You never know.
Mark, feel free when you put this up on the put in my email. I welcome questions. I am not in a position to give investment advice because I'm only licensed to deal with institutional investors.
Yep.
But I love meeting people who think about lean. And if I can help with anything, or if there's a question, most importantly, if I've said something with which they disagree violently, I want them to tell me what it is, because that's how I learn.
Awesome. Very good. And we're going to put your email up across the screen, but cliff@ransomresearch.com, CLIFF at ransom, RANSOM, like Mary, ransomresearch, all one word, .com. That's your email address. And we will lay that across the screen.
Short of plate tectonics or meteor falls, I answer them all within 24 hours.
Yes, you do. And God willing, we're going to have you back and talk more about all kinds of stuff that I didn't get to ask you. So we'll
Thank
go from
you,
there.
Mark.
God bless you, bud. God bless you, my friend. You're looking good. Okay.
Bye-bye.
You bet.
Thanks for listening to the Lean 911 podcast. I'll be happy to address your questions or feedback on future episodes. Email me at mark@lean911.com. You can check out our other episodes by visiting our website at lean911.com, our YouTube channel, wherever you listen to podcasts. This is your host, Mark DeLuzio. Thanks for listening.